Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. This is September 21st, 2016, the last day of summer, and with the intermediation of fall, soon it will be the winter of our discontent. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And assistant online editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
Two blocks from where we sit, a couple of hours ago, came word that they were closing off, NYPD was closing off parts of Times Square because a mysterious package had been found in front of a McDonald's. Now, nothing has happened since, and we've heard no explosions or detonations of devices or anything like that, so we can assume that this was nothing, but of course, it follows a very great and very serious something Saturday night, the improvised explosive device that was in a dumpster on West 23rd Street that went off and killed 29 people, a secondary device found five blocks away on 28th Street that seems to possibly have been disabled because it was inside a piece of luggage and a couple of people came along the street and stole the piece of luggage and removed the device from the luggage and left it on the street corner so that someone said, hey, it looks like there's a pressure cooker sitting on the street corner, and the cops found it, but it may not have been able to go off anyway. An interesting New York wrinkle on the horrifying fact of a follow-up device, a classic terrorist activity, though usually done to be at the site of the crime, the original crime, so that it kills first responders. And here we are a couple of days later, 29 people were injured. Amazing police work was used to find, and public crowdsourcing altogether to find the perpetrator, Mr. Rahami. And of course now the question is, what are the larger meanings and ramifications of this? So we've just spent 15 minutes in here arguing about that. And of course, getting to the most vulgar aspect of this entire thing, which is, whom does this help in the upcoming presidential election? Which is a very sad way to look at something. Although, of course, what policies will be enacted by the next president to do something about these, you know, this cascade of events, beginning with San Bernardino last October, November, followed by the Orlando shooting at the Pulse nightclub, followed by this, and of course on the same night was the shooting in the mall in St. Cloud, Minnesota, where stabbing spree in St. Paul, in St. Cloud, Minnesota, by a 21-year-old security guard. Now, I will say one thing, and then we'll throw this open, which is that 15 years ago, after 9/11, there were two great worries. One was that, of course, there were follow-up plans to follow this with something even more spectacular. The biggest fear being, of course, some kind of a suitcase nuke or a dirty bomb or something like that brought into the United States. And so massive efforts were made. Massive efforts were made to close off any possible entryway, right? So that's why we have security theater at the airports. That's why the TSA was created. That's why the Department of Homeland Security was created. All of these things to prevent these larger events, external forces coming into the United States the way that the 9/11 hijackers did. What's going on here was the other great fear, and it's something that we need to take very seriously, which is that these events, all of the ones that I just mentioned, were perpetrated by American citizens. And this is the great fear, because of course, while you can treat an external force or person as a combatant who can be stopped, and you can use means declaring them an enemy combatant to do all sorts of things, U.S. citizens have all the protections of the Constitution and all the defenses that you can use as a citizen against government overreach and tyranny, which include being able to buy whatever you want on eBay, travel freely to and from whatever country you want to go to without attracting attention, or without it even being legal for the government to come to you and say, hey, why are you going to Pakistan 17 times? because the government has no right to ask that of an American citizen, just as it would have no right to ask me why I've been to Israel 3 times or why you've been to France 4 times or something like that. This is the classic fear of the fifth column, that is the force inside the country that somehow gets together and subverts the country from within using the country's own system of protections. All we seem to know about these sprees is that they seem to be individually, they seem to be the result of individual action. So they can't be described as a fifth column because a fifth column is by definition an organized action within the country. But 15 years on, it now appears that there has been a maturation of the terror war that is now involving Americans. Oh, and the Tsarnaevs, of course, also the Boston Marathon bombers who were American citizens as well. Abe?
Well, you know, this actually follows on a widely distributed document among jihadists about a way to wage global war described as the wilderness, that advocated not waiting to mount an army or to sort of, you know, get governments involved, but to go out into the communities that you are in and cause terror and wage jihad. And ISIS has picked up on this beautifully. This is what they do. I mean, they sort of, you know, they've set up their camp over there, but they're not waiting for you to come there and join them. I mean, if you do, great. But if you're just going to be inspired by them and by their magazine and by their online presence and by their videos and sort of follow their model and take it and use it as a franchise, set up a franchise of your own wherever you are, then that's they're happy with that as well. And all of this really makes the distinction that the Obama administration has tried to make over these past years between sort of real ISIS or real jihadists and what Joe Biden called knockoff jihadists. That distinction is becoming very unsatisfying. And the idea of lone wolf, too, is sort of ceasing to make sense in the old term, because whether they're directly connected or instructed by ISIS, they are now somehow of this, you know, larger entity.
Well, they may be acting alone, but they are being inspired by an ideology that is offering some practical guidance online as to how to take the ideology and make it flesh.
Well, they also take credit for retroactively for just about every event that happens, too. And we don't know whether or not these guys are directed necessarily or inspired by, but that doesn't matter to ISIS HQ. Well, they take credit for whatever they can.
Well, we know that ISIS had claimed that the stabber in St. Cloud was a soldier of ISIS. Something similar has not been said of Rahami, but
and that's kind of the dog that isn't barking here. This was...
Now, Rahami's, of course, alive, so... They may not be doing it because he's alive. So the classic thing is, don't, you know, he's there and they don't want him to reveal what he knows. And we know so far that he's not cooperating, though he has, you know, though he had 3 bullets in him and shot 2 cops.
I mean, just to go to your original points in the opening monologue, this was a very successful terrorist operation. It didn't kill anybody. Wounded a lot of people. But this was a very sophisticated multi-day bombing campaign. And to the extent that we're not talking about a national calamity drenched in blood, it's all luck. He targeted a Marine run on in Seaside Park, and a relay failed. And the race was delayed by a half hour. If that race had not been delayed by a half hour, maybe a lot more of those 3,000 people that were there would have been killed. One of these bombs didn't go off. The bomb that went off in the dumpster absorbed a lot of the blow. The thing went up 2 stories. It was a big, powerful bomb. And then we had the Elizabeth thing, which you said, 2 thieves took a backpack and found a bunch of explosive devices in it and alerted the police to that. Had that gone off when it was supposed to go off 5 hours later at peak Monday morning commute time, hundreds of people in that station would have been killed. So we have, you know, a lot of luck to thank for this thing. And the fact that we had such sophisticated devices. I mean, a lot of them didn't go off. So he wasn't an expert bomb maker. But these are still a lot of bombs. You don't just get to make a whole arsenal of bombs without some sort of external direction.
Right. Well, the external direction could have been literally the recipe to make bombs. You know, 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, there was a gigantic scandal when the New York Review of Books Ramparts magazine put on its cover the instructions on how to make a Molotov cocktail. That was during the, you know, summer of love and the hippie, you know, and the SDS and weathermen and all that, where there was this moment when, you know, American radicals were openly advocating the use of terrorist incendiary devices against cops and military and that sort of thing. Some years later, the Progressive magazine published some kind of a recipe for how to make a nuclear bomb stolen by a Princeton, basically some plans or other dug up by a Princeton student named John Phillips. And they published it in 1982. But of course, you read this stuff and it's like, well, what difference does it make? Anyone could figure out how to make a Molotov cocktail, and anybody can maybe, you know, and it doesn't matter whether you have the plan on how to make a nuclear bomb, because the bomb itself isn't what matters. It's the fissile material that matters. You can't do it without it. And so even though these were great scandals, and obviously there were moral questions about the notion of promoting violence, don't worry about it. Having the ability to find out online how to use a pressure cooker with shrapnel to make a device that will injure the large number of people, that's something else. Because what you need to do is buy a pressure cooker, get some shrapnel and get some instruction on how to use a flip phone, a cell phone that you can get for $29, as the detonator. That's serious. That's within the reach of anybody with a couple hundred dollars who can do that without being observed or without someone calling the cops on him. And that is where being an American citizen is so significant and so frightening. Because, and this is also why the Donald Trump argument that he's the guy you need to turn to for this, because he's going to stop Syrian, you know, he's going to stop Syrian refugees from coming into the United States, is entirely beside the point. We're talking about people who came to the United States, if they were naturalized citizens, as Rahami was, when he was 7 years old in 1995, or the Tsarnaevs who came, you know, in 2005 or something like that. We're not talking about people who were let in because we have a lax immigration policy. These were refugees from war zones. Those policies would, in theory, remain in place. This is not, you know, this is not an immigration issue. This is an issue about whether or not a couple hundred people in the United States, seduced by the messages of Inspire magazine and whatever rage they may have and whatever religious faith they may grow up into, are going to connect the dots and go out and just wreak havoc.
Now that you're pivoting to the vulgar, which I think is the meatier element of this conversation, there's, as you say, as you probably will say, rather, we talked about this beforehand, there seems to be a real fear of playing into a theme that will help Donald Trump among people who are scared to death of Donald Trump.
Right. Now, the real fear, we should say, is from people who don't like Trump, and we're talking about this runs the gamut from President Obama and Hillary Clinton to, you know, 99% of the media to people in the crowd that's called, you know, Never Trump.
As an aside, there was a pretty obscene response to the New York bombing campaign from several different reporters who were noting, well, you know, bombs used to go off in New York City all the time. In the 60s and the 70s, there were bombs all the time. There were bombs in my cafeteria when I was in elementary school. Bombs everywhere. Now, you know, this isn't a really big deal. We should chill out about it. But they're making the point that this is a huge deal because bombs don't go off all the time anymore. This isn't the Bronx is burning New York. And
by the way, those weren't bombs. It's ridiculous. The whole claim is preposterous. That's not the story of New York. The bombs weren't going off in New York all the time. That's just nonsense. It's absolute arrant nonsense, just like some people were saying to me on Twitter. Well, you can't know whether a bombing No, you can't call it terrorism just because there was a bomb in New York City. So what? I mean, it's just a bomb in New York City. How do you know it's terrorism? Name me the case in which a pressure cooker with shrapnel inside was detonated in a city anywhere in the world in the last 40 years, or in which a bomb was detonated in a city in the last 40 years that wasn't a terrorist act. And I will give you $100.
That was connected to three different incidents.
Right. Well, that's the other thing. But I'm just saying, in general, yeah, people do horrible things. They shoot up schools. They shoot up malls. They do terrible. They go crazy and they do horrible things. They don't plant bombs. Planting bombs is a modality for terrorists.
But that's the point that I wanted to make and throw out there and get your reaction to, is that if we have some empirical evidence that suggests the theory that all bad news benefits Donald Trump is a theory in search of evidence. And we can point to the Orlando attack, which was the bloodiest mass shooting in American history. It was perpetrated by a guy who was sympathetic to radical Islam, whose father, he was a naturalized American citizen, his father's a Taliban sympathizer. He killed a lot of people. And Donald Trump's response to that was viewed so negatively that the polls turned against him. Polls showed that he had done pretty well on the issue of terrorism versus Hillary Clinton. And then 2 weeks after the Orlando effect, Hillary Clinton had reversed that and had a very substantial margin on the issue of terrorism. And it was probably all in response to Donald Trump's saying, "I predicted this." Now, it's a different race today. It's September, it's not June. We have a different set of candidates. Hillary Clinton is not as strong as she used to be. Donald Trump is a better candidate, although he's not a disciplined new candidate. But the notion that this is going to automatically redound to Donald Trump's benefit, particularly considering that we've almost already moved on. The news cycle is moving so fast at this stage of the presidential campaign. And because it was a minimal effect, low impact attack, relatively speaking, I don't foresee that there will be much effect on the race. But you saw a lot of people panicking about it.
And I think what actually does redound to Trump's benefit is an element of the panic. It's the fever denial that this is terrorism, that Islam is involved, that it's jihad. I think that's what first gets people saying.
Talk about the reaction that where people were trying to avoid. Because I don't know if anybody knows, it moves so fast that people were trying to avoid calling it terrorism.
Well, yes, but that's been the MO.
No, but literally, I think what Noah's referring to is the fact that the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, described this as an intentional event, and it was literally, I don't know, 16, 17 hours later that he used the word terrorism. And online, and you know, the sort of general sort of liberal mood about this thing was alternately to belittle it by saying, "Oh, well, you know, I live in New York. Nobody cares. But, you know, boy, this guy was an incompetent. He's like a joke." Someone compared it to he was a character in a very, very savage British satirical movie called Four Lions, about four young guys who want to become jihadists, but they're incredibly incompetent at it, which is kind of a brilliant movie. But, yeah, he was so incompetent at it that he injured 30 people. And as Noah says, could have killed hundreds more had a couple of things gone his way. But there was this alternate desire to belittle the impact, and then yet again, for the fifth or sixth time, which I think is what Abe was referring to downplay in a kind of almost crazy way the fact that there had been a terrorist incident in the United States.
Well, he said essentially in the same breath, "This was intentional, yet we have no evidence yet that it's terrorism," which invites people to ask what does an intentional bombing that isn't terrorism mean?
Well, you know, it could be. I mean, I literally, people said maybe it was some crazed form of performance art. That's what one person said on Twitter. That a crazy, disturbed individual might set off a bomb somewhere might not be terrorism, because he could just be some version of Dylan Root or Adam Lanza or one of these people who, you know, shoot up a school or a mall.
Which would have been insane, because the left was demanding that we call Dylan Root's actions terrorism, which we freely did.
Well, and this then gets to a point that Abe wanted to make about the other big news story of the last couple of days, which is these two shootings, one in Charlotte, North Carolina, and then one in Tulsa, Oklahoma, of black men by police. One clearly unbelievably troubling, the one in Tulsa, where it really does look like a guy was walking back to his car as he was instructed to do and was just suddenly shot and killed by a police officer without having any visible weapon or having being threatening. And another incident in Charlotte that is much vaguer. But so we are counseled, so I'm going to set Abe up by saying we are counseled to be patient and prudent and incredibly careful about how we talk about any potential terrorist attack. But what happens, Abe, in the case of a police shooting?
Well, in the case of a police shooting, these videos go viral immediately with everyone assuming the worst, that there has been not only misconduct, but malicious misconduct, right, in all probability racist malicious misconduct.
And what is the conventional wisdom of the sort of chattering class? Is instantly, which is what you were saying, it's instantly to say, the cops have done it again, and, you know, Black Lives Matter, and everything is terrible, and here we have police violence against, you know, racist police violence against black people, before any fact is in, before we know anything other than what has been revealed on the video. And then this helps then encourage what happened in Charlotte last night, which was basically a riot, like yet another riot, in which... And all of that is encouraged by the media, where the media, on the other hand, tell us, if you say boo, if you use the word terrorism, you're inciting violence.
And it's, you know, in some sense, it's more problematic to choose to rush to judgment in the police cases, because in those instances, we have someone who you're already holding accountable, and you've already decided that he's guilty. A bomb goes off, we haven't yet found the person. We don't know who it is, and you're cautioning us not to jump to any conclusion.
You know, there was a remarkable fact I heard this morning, revealed by the NYPD. Now, of course, when Rahami was apprehended, he was in Linden, New Jersey, in a doorway, and this all points bulletin had gone out on everybody's cell phone to say, if you see anybody who looks like this and such, you should get in touch with authorities. And indeed, somebody saw him lying in the doorway and called the cops, that there was a guy lying in a doorway who might match the description. The cops went up to him and woke him up, and he proceeded to shoot two of them. And then they shot him three times, and we've seen the pictures of him on the stretcher. But mostly, this bullet went out to people in New York City. And the idea was, call if you have a tip. So it's New York City. City's on edge. There's been a terrorist attack. How many calls were made to say, I've seen a man who looks like a Muslim on the street. You know, you should go and find him after this. Like, I don't know, 4 million, 5 million people got this text that night. 80. It wasn't 5,000. It wasn't 10,000. It wasn't 20. 80 phone calls were made to the NYPD. You know why? Because people are not crazy. Because people are not looking to burn down mosques and kill every Muslim and think that every Muslim is a terrorist. People take these things seriously. They got this bulletin, and 80 people got in touch with the cops saying, there may be somebody who's walking down my block.
Well, isn't there something to be said then for the very cynical left's narrative, who contended that this terrorist attack had more of an effect of terrorizing the rest of the nation than it did the individuals who were targeted?
But I mean, that's preposterous, because look, my kids barely knew about it, but I know two kids in my seventh graders class who were sobbing, weeping, who were terrified and didn't know what was going on, who live... Now, New York terms is going to sound, they live 3 miles away. Now, in New York, 3 miles is kind of a long way away, oddly, because you're like three or four neighborhoods away, and it takes you about 20, 25 minutes to get from there to another place. It's only 3 miles, but they're 12, so they don't know what, they don't feel that. They're like, oh my God, there was a terrorist attack in New York, and we live in New York. They're too young to have lived through 9/11. But they know all about 9/11. Some of them have been to the memorial site. Some of them have been to the museum. Yeah, it was terrorizing. That's what it's for. It's to make sure that 12-year-olds don't go to sleep at night. And the key about this thing that Abe was talking about the inspiration and the, you know, and the fact that they're now going around doing the terrorists are maybe now going around doing smaller things was always one problem with Al-Qaeda's understanding of the United States, right? Al-Qaeda is what they wanted to do, spectacular attacks, huge things, like, and obviously the World Trade Center was the most spectacular, horrible thing to ever happen in the history of terrorism. But even at the time, there was a sense that if you wanted to do a follow-up attack, hitting a big American institution was not the way you were going to tip America over into madness. That if they shot up some schools, if they went to the Mall of America and just had three guys spraying bullets in a mall, if you went in New York terms, you want to talk about real parochial, like destructive to the, you know, to like the financial center, you would go to the Dalton School and Horace Mann, like places where bankers send their kids, and you would try to blow them up or just kill kids at random like that. That, in 2001, would have sent this country over the edge into a condition of terror, the likes of which we wouldn't have seen. Instead, attacks were isolated in New York and Washington. We had a clear international target, right? We had to go into Afghanistan. We could focus on that. You know, we all wanted to rally and rebuild and recover. And designing these spectacular attacks is really difficult, takes a long time. And obviously, whatever follow-ups they had, and they had a big spectacular attack in Madrid. There was one in London several years later, but not here. Now, maybe we're seeing somebody realizing, you know, if you just make people uncomfortable about going into the mall, you're going to have a real effect on American, just the ongoing American life. Like that is how you leech fear into people's heads. That's what it's like to live in, Israel during the Intifada. It was like, well, you weren't in the Intifada. You weren't, you know, bombs were going up. As long as you weren't there, you were okay. But how did you know walking down the block, a bomb wasn't going to go off somewhere? There were 770 bombs or something, or 4,000 bombs went off in Israel in 3 years, in all sorts of places. So it was just the unsettlement. It was like living under siege. But when you live under siege, at least you know there are guys in uniform over here. There are guys in uniform over there. That wasn't what it was like. Now we are much too big for that to become really likely here. But nonetheless.
But Europe is not. And that strategy is well underway in Europe.
Right.
I mean, you know, you've got individuals mowing down crowds of people with a
right.
bus
in Nice.
Or yeah,
right in Nice, or the attack on the Bataclan, or
shooting up a train in Germany.
Right. And again, you know, your likelihood of being a victim in one of those circumstances is extremely low. And in America, it would be really low because we have 330 million people here and we're territorially vast. But you can still unsettle people, and people do personalize things, as we know from the reaction to the cop shootings. I mean, there are 40 million black people in the United States. Two guys get shot in a single day in two different cities, right? I bet you there were other cop shootings yesterday that maybe involved whites, or this week that maybe involved whites. The point is that a person in Charlotte, North Carolina, now feels like one person shot there could be him. And that's the same in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then all across the country. Real identification. If ISIS can somehow get us to think that any of us is a target at any moment through a series of these attacks, that's terrorism at its best. In some sense, you know, the World Trade Center was something else. It basically hit us at our hardest point, and then we were able to respond to it with our strongest measures. We don't have strong measures against American citizens who do things like that.
Well, yeah, and I just want to add one point, just because it's something I noticed personally on the question of whether or not this terrorized the rest of the country more than New Yorkers. I don't look at dumpsters now on the street the exact same way I did before Saturday. I noticed when I've been passing, you know, and they're on almost every block. When you pass a dumpster now, you think about it. You wonder. I mean, at least a few days afterward.
Yeah, and of course that's something about which you never thought. Exactly. Except if you were trying to park a car and you were like, oh no, there's a dumpster on my block eating up three parking spaces.
Right.
Well, one of the things that we were able to do after 9/11 is externalize our response. We didn't really turn the place into a fortress, although we certainly augmented the military presence on the streets. But the United States was projecting power, and that's something we have resolved not to do in the case of ISIS. Can you stop citizens, not only in the United States, but in places like France and Germany, who are carrying out these attacks, from becoming radicalized? It's possible. We no longer have to worry about Japanese kamikaze attacks because you destroyed an ideology. We no longer have the will or the energy or the enthusiasm to go and project power abroad. We're explicitly saying we will no longer be projecting any power abroad. We won't be destroying this thing on the ground over there. So we don't have any other response
but
to lock the fortress and Katie bar the door.
You know, but this is where politics gets interesting. Here's what I mean. So Hillary gets up and says, Donald Trump is irresponsible. He says he'll stop ISIS, but he doesn't have a plan. I have a plan, and here is my plan. My plan is to do everything that we're doing today and nothing any different. Mm-hmm. Meaning, she says, we're going to continue airstrikes and targeted this, and we're going to try to empower other forces, and we're going to work with our allies, and we're going to blah, 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 blah. Trump then says, I'm going to destroy ISIS, but I'm not going to say how, and we're certainly not going to put any men on the ground, and we're going to steal, we're going to blow up the oil and take the oil, and we're going to bomb the oil, and we're going to do this, but everything that we've ever done in the last 15 years in the Middle East is a mistake. Hillary had, if she were a stronger candidate and a stronger position, she would have a real opportunity here to do something that she cannot do. In other words, if she had established herself as a liked candidate with her own basic coalition behind her that was going for her, she could put some daylight between her and Obama right now and say, look, president has done a yeoman job of, you know, facing this conflict, but, you know, I think we're going to need to do more. When I'm president, we are going to have to roust them out of their place and make sure that salt the ground so they cannot come back. And that may require using different means than we've used now. I commend the president for his vitality and his vision and all of this, but I don't think it's been enough. And history will record that in the internal debates of the administration, I argued for more forceful responses in these cases in trying to make sure that the Middle East stabilized and didn't turn into a sinkhole. She cannot say this or do this because she does not have her hands on the Democratic coalition or the Obama coalition. And so just at a moment when she could really use the ability to say, I'm a different person, I'm going to chart a slightly different path, she can't, because she's going to need him to help her drag the Obama coalition over the finish line, get the enthusiasm of Democrats up to beat Donald Trump.
Right. In fact, it comes at a moment when she's hemorrhaging the youth vote to Gary Johnson, a libertarian, a man who's not sure that we should have been in World War II.
Right.
You know, and is not really quite clear on what Aleppo is.
So, I mean, look, they don't know who Gary Johnson is. They've never heard of Gary Johnson. They got no idea about Gary Johnson. Maybe a few of them, if they're really, you know, budheads, know that he's like, you know, he's Mr. Marijuana. But they don't know Gary. Gary Johnson is just not Hillary now, or not Hillary, or not Trump now. If Gary Johnson does okay in this election, meaning if he gets 8-10% or something like that in this election, boy, that's going to be a sign that almost everything that we've been told about the last 7 or 8 years is a lie. That is to say that there's been we know it's a lie anyway, that, you know, Obama has changed the Democratic Party, that the Democratic Party, you know, once people vote, they're going to vote forever, and, you know, their first vote that they cast is very important because it anchors them in a party and you'll never get them back, blah, 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 blah. So it turns out that candidate quality is going to matter. that you have these two incredibly unpopular candidates, that Hillary Clinton apparently has a unique inability to win over people who need some kind of rallying cry message, something to stir them, not to just, you know, vote because you're supposed to, but because you want to. And it is, again, a mark of the unbelievable irresponsibility and fecklessness of the Obama Democratic Party that it let her sail into this nomination without testing her during the primaries to see whether or not she could withstand what was going to come her way. And why did they do that? As I wrote in a piece in the New York Post on Sunday, they did it. Why did they? We talked about it last week. They did it because they thought that every issue that Republicans were raising against her, the emails and Benghazi and her general trustworthiness and all of that, were just right-wing nonsense that nobody was going to care about. And the fact that they talked themselves into something that convenient without thinking through what it meant that she had gone down 15 or 20 points in popularity from when she left the Secretary of Stateship to when she started running for office, and that Obama still did what he could to keep there from being a real race in the Democratic Party. They are going to own this defeat if she loses. If she loses, it's not going to be that Trump won. I really believe that. It's going to be that she lost. Democrats have every structural advantage. They have every tonal advantage. They have every cultural advantage. She's a terrible candidate. Now, I think that doesn't mean she's going to lose, but it is really stunning that she finds herself in a position where she can't make an argument about arguably the thing that could help her get elected, because she'll alienate too many people that she should just have in her pocket.
Well, I also think that she has some pretty obnoxious liberal bugs in her ear that are telling her that the cohort of 18 to 24 voters are really into non-interventionism, and because you have a lot of supporters who are interventionist hawks, that they're turned off by that. Those are people who write for The Intercept, and I think they have a lot of influence over some of the thinking inside of Hillary Clinton's liberal circles. And like you said, she's had to wrap her arms around Barack Obama, and in order to contradict him in a fashion on something as seriously detrimental to his legacy as Syria, would probably turn off quite a few Democrats. But
we're
not talking.
The issue is not whether it would turn off Democrats; it's whether it would turn him off.
By Democrats, I mean people within the orbit of the president,
right, fair
and
enough.
Influential members right. of the establishment inside the Democratic Party. We're not talking about young voters who are, frankly, unaware of, I think, a lot of the details of foreign policy, or really all that. More or less indifferent to foreign policy in general, whether it's military interventionism or not. But yes, the influential set of Democratic policymakers who are urging Hillary Clinton to be as far left-wing as she possibly can, and she's done that. She has drifted as far left, farther to the left than Barack Obama has. She's ambiguous and non-ideological in ways on foreign policy. She's not approaching foreign policy as Barack Obama did, with an ideological chip on his shoulder designed to reduce the stature of the United States, to create it just one member of a family of nations, to rehabilitate rising powers and to get them to work with us on our policy objectives, namely to nuclearize Iran. These were things that Barack Obama had intentionally designed, what he wanted to accomplish when he went into office. I don't know what Hillary Clinton wants to accomplish in terms of foreign policy when she gets into office, beyond to maintain the current geopolitical order.
You don't know what she wants to accomplish altogether, and this is where there was a thing that happened the other day that put me in mind of my first book, Hell of a Ride, which was about the decline and fall of the first Bush administration, the George H.W. Bush administration, and the campaign that he lost to Bill Clinton and arguably also to Ross Perot. And that is this, that she came out and said on Monday morning that Trump was somehow responsible for the terrorist attack because he was a recruiting poster for ISIS because he was such an Islamophobe. Now, when I heard this, I thought, you know, they have so much money. They're spending so much money on big data. They've done so much research. They've done it. They must know that this message resonates. Because when you hear it for the first time, it's like saying, what, Trump is responsible for a jihadist becoming a jihadist? That doesn't compute. Someone's not going to like hear Donald Trump and say, okay, I'm going to go make a pipe bomb and I'm going to go make a shrapnel bomb. And I thought, well, but you know, maybe they know what they're doing. Like they look, this is a series that a lot of these people got Obama elected in 2012. That was a fantastic campaign and brilliantly rendered campaign. And so they got to know what they're doing. And then I had this other thought, and this is goes back to Hell of a Ride. So Bush had this team in 2012, led by a couple of people. One of them, his name was Bob Teeter. And, you know, the Bush campaign did stuff. So Bush campaign, Bob Teeter sat down with the speechwriters. This is a chapter in my book. And they sat down with the Bush speechwriters. And he said, we've got 9 areas of focus in this campaign. You know, we've got demographics. We've got this. We've got that. We got this. We got this. And then we got that. And then he sort of drew a chart. And then he had a box in the middle. And the box, and they had all sorts of things in this chart. And then the box in the middle said message, and it was empty. And he said, so what we need from you is to help us fill this box. Because Bush didn't have a message, meaning he had no argument to make about why he should be reelected. He had no argument. He didn't, his own campaign had no idea what he was running for or to be. And I had this flashback and I thought, you know, maybe this is the empty box. Maybe this is just Hillary going out and saying whatever the hell it is that she's saying because she doesn't have a clue how to talk about him. And then this morning, as we speak, Robbie Mook, her campaign manager, went on Morning Joe, and Mike Barnicle, who had upended the Gary Johnson campaign by asking Gary Johnson what he was going to do about Aleppo, and Gary Johnson said, what is Aleppo? He said to Robbie Mook, what are you going to do about Aleppo, basically? And Robbie Mook said, I don't handle policy. You have to ask her. You know, that's not my job. I'm not here to talk about policy. And they basically said, you're not going to talk about what the Clinton campaign's approach is to Syria? And he was like, no, you can ask Hillary Clinton.
He said, well, you're introducing a new question. And if we're introduced talking about new policy, then we should loop her into it. So they said, okay, well, once she had said that she supported a no-fly zone in Syria, is that still the case? And he said, well, I'm going to let her words speak for themselves. And he didn't comment on the old policy
and
or on the new policy.
And he's the campaign manager. He's not like, you know, the money guy or the he went on TV as her campaign manager to be her surrogate on the most watched show of the sort of political elite in the morning.
But this goes back to your point. She can't say why she no longer supports a no-fly zone because it contradicts Barack Obama. The no-fly zone thing made a lot of sense until Russian warplanes were all over the skies, and we had to work out a deconfliction agreement in order to make sure we weren't shooting at each other.
Hey, and now, what's going on now with the great Syrian, remember the great Syrian ceasefire of last week that was violated 2 hours into this? I think we even talked about this at some point. It was going to take, you know, how long was it going to take for the ceasefire to be violated? So not only that ceasefire, not only is it no longer in effect, but there is so much confusion about who's doing what, where, how, that we're mistakenly bombing things. Russia's mistakenly bombing things, or maybe not so mistakenly bombing things.
According to the United States.
Yeah.
Bombing
right.
UN convoys.
Bombing UN convoys.
The United States alleges that Russia attacked a UN convoy of aid into Aleppo deliberately. The Russians contend that the United States, and we apologized for attacking and killing 60 Syrian soldiers. And we have now the Russian, the chief flagship Russian aircraft carrier, which is en route to the Syrian coast as we speak. A lot of assets, all in the same place. Everybody's shooting at each other's proxies. This is really dangerous.
Boy, that John Kerry, he really knows how to make an agreement. You know, it's really fantastic. You know, at some point, you know, somebody from inside that administration is going to tell us, as some of people did in the first term, right? Bob Gates did in his book Duty, you know, which is a pretty staggering indictment of the functioning of the internal functioning of the Obama administration. I mean, imagine
who this week endorsed Hillary Clinton,
right? Yeah. But imagine the Bob Gates book about John Kerry in the second term. I mean, that, I don't know who's going to write it, and I don't know how it's going to come out, but I mean, this parade of comic misdirection, it really does make you think, like, what on earth would this country have been? Everybody knows the second Bush term was a disaster, but, you know, and no one can argue that the terrible things didn't happen and the meltdown and all of that. But, I mean, John Kerry as president, when we see what's happened during his tenure as Secretary of State, is truly, truly a terrifying thought. I mean, thank God that didn't happen, because you may think the meltdown was bad, and that, you know, the response to Katrina was bad and all sorts of things were bad. Well, he has achieved a level of bumbling incompetence and allowing his enemies to take control of the narrative, the likes of which I don't think we've ever seen.
Just to put a period on this thing is that all of this sort of amounts to a change sentiment, which is where we should be. Everybody kind of forgets because Donald Trump has kind of obscured it because he's really lackluster candidate and people don't trust him. But the GOP went into this year with a lot of baked-in advantages, and I think we've seen some of those return with Hillary Clinton's terrible week. She had an awful week, and she sort of bottomed out. I think we've seen the bottom already, but maybe not. But Donald Trump didn't so much benefit as did the Republican Party's Senate incumbents. We've seen a huge rebound on the part of the GOP's Senate incumbents to the point now where we're kind of a toss-up as to whether or not the Republican Party loses the Senate, which was gone in the beginning of July.
But, you know, part of this also goes to the fact that everybody is flying blind. That is to say, there was this thing called the Obama Coalition. All Hillary had to do with a divided Republican Party was summon the Obama Coalition back up. I remember it was smaller in 2012 than it was in 2008. He lost 4 million votes between 2012, from 2008 to 2012. But of course, there are a great many more voters because this country is so big that more people come online to vote. And all indications are that, you know, who's turning 18, 19, 20 is much more likely to be on the left than on the right. So all she needs to do is assemble this coalition, and we don't know that she has or is going to. Meanwhile, Trump has this shrinking coalition, right? It's smaller. It's like, because he's so white-driven, Hispanics are hostile.
It's more male.
More male, like losing educated women and all of who have voted, you know, who have voted Republican since 1952, all of that. And yet he makes this claim, which is now backed up by a certain amount of evidence for the first time in some of this polling, that he may be activating people who haven't voted for a long time, or people who've never voted or something like that, who are, you know, keying to his message. And so all the polling that we are seeing is trying to model an electorate that nobody really understands now. I mean, that's I think, part of the difficulty here. And why some of these polls are so wildly varying. I mean, they're not varying that much. Like, we know the race is tight and it's now a 2 or 3 point race. Somehow it doesn't feel like, I don't know how you guys feel, the dynamics of this race do not speak to it being a squeaker in one direction or another. That doesn't seem to be, you know, he's too much of an X factor candidate. And she, if she's minimally competent or the campaign is minimally competent, should be able to generate those 65 million votes simply using technical means to get unenthusiastic voters to the polls, which is what Obama did.
I mean, that's a logical case, right? Yeah. I mean, we know that he has almost no staff. He's got, like, she has four staffers to his one. She's got a turnout machine. He does not. He's outsourced his campaign operation to the committees. They don't do turnout. So, I mean, the logical thing is that, yes, she will outperform her polling average by about 2 points on election day, and like Barack Obama did. And then there's the emotional approach to it, where you kind of, if you're in the news cycle, right in the middle of the news cycle, total blinders on, looking at what you're seeing today, and you're seeing Barack Obama panic and deliver a cloying emotional appeal to black voters, saying, you will personally hurt my feelings if you do not vote for Hillary Clinton. You see Hillary Clinton's campaign engaging in their 7th reset, I think, of the campaign, really publicly saying they need to reintroduce themselves to voters, make a positive appeal to millennials. They're acting like they're losing. And it's hard to ignore that.
It's true.
And you're waiting for them to get some traction. You're waiting them to sort of find their footing and change things. And you just watch her campaign day by day, and it's bad and bad and worse.
Right. But You look at those numbers, you look at all the numbers forever, and you see Trump in the very low 40s, high 30s, very low 40s, and then you see Hillary sinking from the mid to high 40s into the low 40s. You don't see Trump climbing into the mid 40s or high 40s, and you see in various polls these kind of weird surges for Gary Johnson, or you know, numbers of undecided voters, the likes of which we have not seen in a quarter century. 17-18% undecided. That was not uncommon when the parties were less ideologically defined and when the electorate was less aligned to each party. Because, of course, you had the circumstance in which you had people who were nominally Democrats by way more numbers than Republicans constantly electing Republicans to the presidency. So obviously people crossed over. They were undecided. You had Democrats voting for Reagan. You had Democrats voting for Nixon. You know, that kind of thing. That sort of ended. So you don't really think now that a partisan Democrat is going to switch over and vote for Trump, or that a partisan Republican is switch over and vote for Hillary. But as a result, you have this kind of withdrawal of affect from everybody who isn't firmly aligned that was supposed to not happen anymore. And so I don't know that we are seeing data that, you know, all this is about feeling. Like in the early August, it felt like Trump had basically just blown himself out of the race with Khazir Khan and everything else, and how incompetent the Republican convention was, and how ineffectual his speech was, and how successful the Democratic convention was, and all that. And then Hillary got all this external bad news, you know, the release of the FBI notes on her interview, and then, of course, her not only her illness, but her clear deceit about how sick she was and the refusal to admit that she was sick. And then, of course, her deplorables comment, which I know Noah still thinks was a potential political masterstroke.
The data doesn't suggest.
It doesn't suggest that it was bad.
Thing. No, but according when you're to talking, Gallup survey, what people heard that week wasn't deplorables, but was her health. And lies.
I understand, but all I'm saying to you is that when you're talking about something that you don't want to talk about on a campaign, and she didn't want to spend 5 days. You thought it was great for them to spend 5 days talking about whether or not she was insulting people by saying deplorables. And I don't think that that's really what they wanted to talk about. And so they had lost control of their own story. And speaking of narratives and controls of narratives, was there ever a worse presidential comment in the history of presidential comments than Josh Earnest, the president's spokesman, saying that the problem with the terrorist attack and Trump was who was going to win the narrative war on whether or not ISIS was having good luck in the United States?
And of course, the joke there is Obama's their administration is the one that constantly says, what do you care about how we speak about it? What counts is what we're doing.
Our actions.
Our deeds,
not words.
Right. If we say the right things, that will magically resolve the problem. And now they're saying, it's all about the narrative.
It's all about the narrative. I mean, if you're helping the terrorists by saying that they've had a success, because all they need is to win the narrative. So you're actually being un-American to say that maybe, you know, our response is ineffectual. But to get back to the point at the very beginning of this podcast, we are at a hinge moment in seriousness here, because this we have a glimpse of a possible dystopian future in Rahami and Mateen and Tsarnaev, and I can't remember the name of the San Bernardino bomber and the stabber in St. Cloud, which is terrorist attacks being taking place on American soil by American citizens. We cannot, you know, despite all the talk about how all of our freedoms were being, you know, seized from us and we were doing warrantless wiretapping and all of that was about accessing information abroad from and not about finding out things at home, right? We already know that, you know, look what happened when we tried to get Apple to help us break the San Bernardino bomber's cell phone. Apple would not do it apparently on the very rational grounds that they would have been violating somebody else's constitutional rights had they done so, even though the FBI was asking them to, and that they would be, you know, was that they were not allowed to do this, and they weren't, you couldn't give them, you know, like a get out of jail free pass. That's not how America works. and all of the means and modalities that people used in the United States to track potential domestic terrorism in the 60s and 70s have been removed from laws have been passed to make it impossible for the FBI to do domestic intelligence surveillance, which it did against the weathermen and SDS and people like that, because they were also doing it against Martin Luther King and other people who should not have been investigated. So we are, you know, we are at a tipping point, and I think, you know, Trump's lack of sophistication here may hurt him, because if he's going to walk around saying, I can fix this because I'm going to prevent Syrian refugees from coming in the United States, that is not the problem. That is not the direct, that is not the clear and present danger. It's people who have been here for 20 years, not people who are who might come, you know, in tiny numbers over the next 5 years.
But I would suggest, cynically, that it may help him because it's as unrealistic as it is, it's realizable. What is not realizable is what I think would truly neutralize the threat, and that is addressing it abroad. And nobody wants to hear that.
Right. Nobody does want to hear that. But of course, and that's the joke of Hillary's response, right? Is until somebody says, we have to, you know, we're all, everybody's saying we need to degrade and destroy ISIS, right? That's the cliche. We're going to destroy ISIS. We're going to get rid of them. We're going to. Any rational attempt, as we've said 10,000 times here, and that is frightening to say, even as I say it, because I know everyone thinks we're just warmongers who want to have perpetual war in the Middle East. But the only way that you destroy ISIS is you roust them out of their semi-caliphate, and then you have to stay there so they don't come back in. You have to build a wall,
if Hillary's
one might
policy,
say, and make them pay for it.
If Hillary's policy is the president's policy, then it's sort of, you know, a gradual draw of forces into a conflict that we can't really control, and we don't really have any mission statement.
Gee, that sounds like Vietnam, doesn't it? That actually does sound like Vietnam.
It's almost exactly like
that.
Vietnam.
Is total
we
Vietnam.
Call it Iraqization.
Total Vietnam. But Trump's line is, I'm going to destroy ISIS and get you jobs, and you're going to have magically, you're going to have delivered everything that you might ever, you know, conceivably want. While I distort the United States by claiming that lives in black neighborhoods have never been worse, and everything is terrible, and life is horrible, none of which is true, and which is not intended to, by walking around saying, you know, lives of black people have never been worse in the United States, that's the odd part. It sounds compassionate. It's actually quite the opposite. It's, in fact, a way of saying to white people, boy, black people are in bad shape. You better elect me, because it's me. I'm the only one standing between you and the black people who are having such terrible lives.
Well, he spoke this actual sentence the other day in a speech. Our inner cities are horrid.
Yeah. They've never been worse. There are places in Afghanistan that are better than our inner cities.
Yes.
And then you have people on the conservative right side who are saying, well, at least he's reaching out to black people. Nobody else on our side is ever reaching out. He's not getting any credit for it. This black outreach, at least Donald Trump is talking to African-American voters.
Yeah. I mean, look, there are inner cities, you know, there is Chicago, which is in a desperately bad condition. But, you know, I repeat, as you constantly do, because half of people weren't alive then. People have no idea what this country was like in the 70s, 80s in the inner cities. I mean, or not just the inner city, but the parts of the cities that weren't the inner city. I mean, to say the South Bronx is worse now than it was in 1979 is such a disgusting, deceitful thing to say, that, you know, life in Washington, D.C.'s inner city is worse than it was in 1990 when, you know, there were the equivalent of 10,000, you know, if it were New York, there would have been 10,000 homicides per capita if there had been the murder rate in New York that there was in D.C. or New Orleans, which was the murder capital of the world, or of the United States, or almost any place that is better. And black lives are better. That's the horror of this. Like, by every measure, black lives, there's less crime, there's more, you know, income, people are doing better. There was a giant jump in personal income in 2015, higher at the lower end than at the higher end, close to 10% for the first time in 15 years. Lives are better, and Trump is then echoing the, you know, disgraceful rhetoric of the Black Lives Matter movement by claiming that living as a black person in America is a Hobbesian, is to live in a Hobbesian state of nature. It's just horrifying that this should be the line that is being proffered. And as I say, there's like some kind of merger of left and right here in promulgating this myth that also talks people into the notion, as Trump does also when he talks about the lives of white people and what's happened to them.
But that's what creates this myth that, and I think it is a myth, that all bad news redounds to Trump's benefit, because his campaign is predicated on the idea that everything is bad and getting worse. It's never been worse. You're terrible. You need to invest all your faith in me, because it is entirely faith. And we just don't have a lot of evidence to suggest that's the case. That message has got him to 44-45%. And I mean, if it's 1992 and 45-44% is the plurality you need to win, then I guess that'll take you over the edge. But I really don't see these third-party candidates getting double-digit amounts
of support. One final thought here, which is that Trump's message on the latest terrorist attack would resonate much better if Rahami hadn't been caught in, you know, 36 hours. In other words, if there hadn't been this like extraordinarily competent response to this event, where, you know, within, you know, and this complicated thing where the citizenry played a real part in apprehending him, so that there was a kind of buy-in, not only from authorities and local authorities, by the way, the NYPD, which and local New Jersey authorities, who clearly have a lot to be, you know, proud of in, you know, this week, whereas the FBI has somehow had to reveal that it was on the trail of Rahami in 2014, but saw no links to anything, and so they stopped watching him after his own father had called him a terrorist and blown the whistle on him. And again, now this may be the FBI saying he's a U.S. citizen, and we don't have the means, we don't have the right, we don't have the constitutional authority to do anything more in watching him. Or they could have just watched him. Like, you can watch a guy, you can like have a car outside his house. No, that's not. Who says you can't have a car outside his house?
Here's the other interesting thing about
But the FBI is not in good odor. So the FBI, can combine that with the FBI, with the Comey saying Hillary Clinton is a crook and I'm not arresting her. You know, Hillary Clinton, you know, put this nation's security at risk, but I'm not indicting her. Not a good couple of months for the FBI.
And here's the interesting thing about the police shooting stories and the terrorist story arising at the same time. The police did a fantastic job, and yet they are under attack for presumably shooting innocents all the time. And if, as you've been saying, we're due for more domestic terrorism of this sort of Americans,
we don't know if we're due for it. I'm just saying we now have a basically a trail that might be suggesting.
Yeah. Right. But the police are going to be playing a larger and larger role. At a time when they are sort of under fire for being proactive.
And let me give a local shout out, because this is very important. Because the fact is, despite the fact that the epicenter of garbage nonsense about the police is New York City from 1987 onward, by the administrations of the disgusting Al Sharpton and other people, and this argument, you know, all the arguments about the evils of cops really kind of, you know, sort of came out of New York in the 70s and 80s and reached their nadir when David Dinkins, then the mayor before Rudy Giuliani, actually paid for the funeral of a guy named Kiko Garcia, who was shot by a cop named Michael O'Keefe in Washington Heights in New York City. And O'Keefe said that he had been threatened and that he was in danger. And Dinkins sided with the family. And it turned out that, A, O'Keefe was telling the truth, that Garcia brandished a gun and nearly shot him, and B, that Garcia was the head of a violent drug ring. And the New York City mayor sympathized with his family and paid for his funeral. I mean, that's how low things had gotten here. And Rudy Giuliani came in and he basically said, if you attack the cops, I'm going to defend the cops. 20 years, the cops in the city have kept the peace. people keep attacking them. People keep saying they're a bunch of racists because they did stop and frisk and they did this and they did that. The number of incidents involving policemen in New York City brandishing their guns and using the guns over the last 5 years is unbelievably small. They're incredibly well trained. And when push comes to shove, they are a fantastic police department, as we have just seen. And, you know, it's again a mark of how repellent the common discussion has gotten that, you know, maybe in these cases in Oklahoma and Charlotte, you're dealing with police who are maybe less trained, who are more nervous, who basically have less confrontation with bad actors and are therefore, you know, they are less responsible when it comes to dealing with their weaponry because they're more scared when they face trouble. I don't know what it is, but, you know, New York City cops are the best cops in America and likely the world.
I'm not just talking about New York City PD, but also
Linden, New Jersey.
Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Two cops shot.
New Jersey.
Two shops, right. And two shops shot in Linden, yeah. In Linden, New Jersey, trying to apprehend Rahami. I mean,
and then took him down,
and they didn't kill him, which is the other interesting aspect of this. Clearly, he wanted to die a martyr's. I'm sure he wanted to die a martyr's death.
Well, I mean, to lay yourself down on a stoop, you know, when there's a manhunt for you,
Well, so we have come to the end of another joyous visit to America in 2016. As we enter the autumn, Commentary Magazine is approaching now its 72nd year as America's foremost monthly of intellectual, critical, social analysis, arguing for the West and the United States and its institutions from the highest level of intelligence that we can muster, and standing as a bulwark against anti-Semitism and a supporter of the State of Israel. Please join us at commentarymagazine.com. Come to us. You get some free reads of our material, and then we ask you to subscribe. $19.99 for a digital subscription. $29.99 gets you all access, plus our beautiful monthly magazine with a great issue coming out just today or tomorrow with a remarkable piece by James Pethakoukas on the question of how bad is the great American slowdown, and three really wonderful short stories which I commend to your attention. So for Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz, and we'll talk to you again next week.